Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and when I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at one of our restaurants, Dell'Anima, Lartuzzi, La Picho, or Alta Linea, which is our restaurant just for this summer over at the Highline Hotel, or a wine bar, Anfora, where I serve as the beverage director for a small group of downtown New York City restaurants. And if you like this show, you can find other shows or listen to this episode again in the future on www.heritageradionetwork.org, or you can listen to it on iTunes. Very excited about our guest today. This is someone who scares me a little bit, actually, because I cannot consume his writing enough. Otherwise, my bank account will certainly be the lesser for it. His name is John Rimmerman. He's the founder of Garage East. For those of you who aren't aware of Garage East, and I guess that the majority of our listeners do know it, it's a newsletter, a wine newsletter, that really features some of the most authentic, real, beautiful wine and writing about wine. I get so excited that about the wine that I usually am unsubscribed from your list, John. And despite that, I have plenty of friends, my regular friends, my industry friends, regulars in our restaurants who are constantly peppering me with your email saying, hey, check this out. Did you see you wrote about this? You see about that? And so I undoubtedly am always tuned into what you're doing anyway. So I'm excited to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it. Just with that point, you know, they sometimes call us like the Pony Express of the wine business because somehow we get the mail to you. Whether it's forwards, friends, or whatever, people, you know, I hear that story a lot all over the world. Please unsubscribe me. Wait, don't unsubscribe me. I want to read it. So no, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I have to say that not only, you know, do I then receive these forwards, I also look at it as useful training tools for the people in who work with me at the restaurants. A lot of the wines that you're excited about, we have on our lists, and certainly if it's an Italian wine and I don't know about it, I immediately seek that out. But when you write about something that we've worked with for a long time, I know you've been big on Canalicchio di Sopra Brunello recently. I will send that out to everyone on my wine team and say, hey, this is some great writing on this. You should know about. So thank you for helping me out with that as well.
That's another thing that I hear quite often. So thank you. You know, the thing about Garage East is that it is information first. That's what it always has been. It's, really a journal of my life around the world. It is not about the selling aspect of anything. I think everyone sort of gets that. And even, you know, my gosh, 20 years on, which is unbelievable to think that it's been that long. It's still every day, just like coming here this morning, you know, trying to get here from Seattle, going to the UK later this afternoon. It's a journey. And doing this little show with you today is part of that journey. It's about getting information out of it and about having people read and enjoy and converse about what the writing is about. It's just that's what makes it fun for me still. So when it becomes something that's a selling thing, I probably will stop doing it.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite part about wine is the sense of discovery and finding new things. And you are still actively doing it all the time. You said this is just like New York is a tiny little stopover for you on this massive trip. Does it get exhausting after doing it for 20 years? It sounds like you have this insane travel schedule. Yeah. I envy it a little bit because I really would love to visit all the producers that you do.
I'm exhausted right now. No, it is, yes, but I love the life that I have. And there are so few people in the world that can say they've created a life for themselves. Really that they could, you know, get up every single day and do something for hundreds of thousands, you know, some would say over a million people around the world every day at this point, and that it's still a big family, a small big family. And it, while it is exhausting physically, and of course as I get older it becomes more exhausting, but the discovery part, even from when I was 18, 20 years old, is what fuels me. And, you know, most people know at this point we don't just do wine. It's about art. It's about foodstuffs. It's about something culturally important, you know, of the moment in its place. And, of course, this predates Twitter, all of the social media. This was about literally pounding the pavement and finding something in the moment that you took a snapshot of in your mind, because this was before there were any phones. And somehow I had to recant that story, you know, via text. And that's one of the reasons why we still to this day never show images.
Yeah. And that's so interesting. You're able to sell and sometimes very high-end products without any pictures of labels or vineyards or charming winemakers and you know, anything like that. And it's really done strictly on the strength of your writing and your words.
Again, great point. When I, you know, have interviewed with people like Forbes and, you know, business journals, they want to know, oh my gosh, what's the secret sauce to Garage East? How can we copy this? How can we tell, you know, the listeners around the world or you know, that are going to read the magazine? You've hit it on the head right there. The secret sauce of Garage East is the writing and the relationship that I have with people everywhere. Okay. And, you know, people are listening today and they want to think about how can I start my own business? It's not, you know, maybe it's wine or anything else or food or restaurants. You have to make that connection with people personally. There's so much noise out in the world every day, whether that's electronic or just on the street. And if you find a way to connect with people, which I fortunately have for all of these years, stick to something very simple and very basic. And for me, that the basic quality that we started with at the beginning was the writing.
Yeah. And it feels like you're getting an email from a trusted friend who's like, guys, yeah, this is awesome. You need to know about this. What, even if it's like an email from a friend about a restaurant, like, hey, Joe, I know you would love this restaurant. And then since that's a trusted friend you've known for years, they know that they like, you know, you like what they like, then you're going to trust them and go for it. And that's what your emails feel like. They feel very real and authentic.
There are many people from Facebook, you know, you could go all the way down the line of, again, social media companies that have come since I started. So many of those people are on my mailing list, and they privately will email me or they'll call me and ask me for tips about, you know, gigantic decisions and things. It's really quite flattering, and I'm not sure why they're doing it, to be honest with you. But what it shows is that what we are doing and the simplicity of it still rings so true to people that everything comes around again. And we have made things very complex with technology, but so many people still want something very human that they can connect with. And by not showing images, by not, you know, flooding you with HD videos and all these things that basically everyone in my industry does every day, the Garage East email and the writing forces you to create the images in your head for yourself. And my original idea when I first started was I wanted to have this read not only as a journal, but as a novel going around the world. And when you read a novel, they don't show you pictures, correct? You imagine all the characters inside your own mind. It's very different from how your neighbor would, you know, imagine the exact same character that they're reading in the same book. Mm-hmm. So usually when we think of our own images and we think of our, let's say we read the story just with ourselves, you know, in our own head, we create a really positive image for what that story is. When you are shown an image, someone is telling you what you should see and what you should think. It's a very, very different approach. And so after all of these years, it's what we do and we don't change it.
And it's brilliant. You said you've been around for over 20 years, and you also touched on that you're trying to hit on what is culturally relevant and culturally important. And it sounds like there are some constants, but has that changed when it comes to wine over the last 20 years? Do you think of there being multiple eras within those times?
Again, great question. Yes, so much so. When I started, there were very, very few people, really, even around the world. I mean, you could go to the wineries and into the vineyards who cared about natural winemaking and organics and biodynamic winemaking and getting back to the land, let's say, or the slow food eco movement. That was nowhere to be found. It was all really about commercialization, tonnage, more wine, more. And wine was thought of more of as a commodity, which unfortunately to this day still is very true. But the I would say the number one thing is awareness around the world in youth culture. The youth of today is hyper aware of not only what's good for their body or what they do and do not want to put into their body food-wise, but also drink-wise. And with the whole, you know, bar smith explosion and cocktails, these things all go hand in hand. But for me, awareness of youth culture, what they want to see, what they don't want to see as far as food and wine, but also the producers themselves, where when I started, it was also about selling something and trying to create something to feed their families. Yes, they still feel that way, but it's so much more important to them to connect with the end user and to give the end user a food, quote unquote, that is healthy for them. And that's a gigantic bridge that really has gone all over the world.
Right. And there's been this evolving of being a farmer from something where you did it and you kind of just scraped by, and you did it because you had to do it because that's the life your family was built into. So now a lot of people do it as a choice. They're excited to be farmers.
Yes. And the rules in all the European countries, you know, which is where we predominantly do most of our work, they're all different, which is as far as inheriting estates. There are very punitive estate taxes. When, let's say, a father dies and they give the estate to their children, it's really a shame. It is almost better for them to sell the property than to inherit it. So this is something we're running up against quite a bit right now, especially in France. And it is bringing in a lot of foreign investment, which I really don't, and I have nothing against it, of course, but I really love to see the children who want to stay with that land and learn what they learned from grandfather, father, you know, the classic old situation. Not everybody can do it. But I've found many, many cases that there are two types of family wineries. One is that's handed down. And the other is one where the son or daughter decides, my father was doing this in a terrible way. You know, we have great land, but he had no idea what he was doing. And he wants to actually do something beneficial for the world. That's a very different mentality than how it was when I started. When I started, they wanted to do something special for their town.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, because of, again, social media and the internet, the winemakers and, again, youth culture connection around the world, they feed off of one another. And the winemaker that I may visit in Georgia or in Turkey, he is hyper aware of the person in New York City who wants to drink his wine. That's totally different.
And, completely yeah. different. And we had a producer on the show, Sandy Skerk from Friuli, who was talking about the generational differences. And I think it's similar to what you're hitting on right now, how his father modernized everything from the grandfather's way and mechanized and started using chemicals. And so his father rebelled from his father. Now he's rebelling from his father and going back to the way the grandfather is doing things.
As I said, everything comes full circle. It's the same thing with Garage East and how we deliver our story, you know, every day. At some point, people get oversaturated with the noise, and they want to come back to the most basic virtues. Let's say that, okay? Whether it's the land itself and letting Mother Nature and the insects rule and govern what the vintage is going to be, or again, it's the delivery of a message that you get in your inbox every day.
And was that clear to you, this mission of choosing wines that were made in a more handmade way without the chemicals straight from the beginning, early on in your career, or is that something that you've kind of evolved on?
No, that was something that was really important to me. I was literally spat at, I was clawed at, cat fights, I mean, the whole thing, because what back then, besides maybe Joe Dresner, you know, rest in peace, no one cared about it. You know, Kermit Lynch to an extent, but it wasn't really the mantra. He was just looking for great wines, you know, regardless of how they were produced. Most of them were produced in a natural way. But I was working a little bit in the organic food business back then, which again was pre, you know, the whole foods explosion, all of these things. And I would go around the world, and invariably a farmer would say, oh, you know, you're coming to look at my olive oil or something that I'm growing here, basil, but I have this 2 acre of vineyard that I don't know what to do with. Can you take some of my wine? Now, they didn't realize in the United States you can't just buy wine and olive oil and kind of bring them over. It doesn't work like that. But that was sort of the genesis of how I met a lot of the contacts that I still have today, was from my organic food background when I was very young. And it propelled me because I thought back then, which I still do today, and I actually wrote about this the other day, that why is wine still the only unregulated food that we have in this country? You have to think of it as a food. You go into a grocery store, they have the organic food section, you know, et cetera. But in many cases, the wine section is absolutely ridden with chemicals. It's ridden with additives, preservatives. There's 100 chemicals in some bottles of wine. So that was something that I knew back then. It wasn't as pervasive, the knowledge, but yes.
Yeah, that's crazy. And then there's this really, I think, just horrible system of labeling where the only additive that you have to put on is the contained sulfites.
Exactly.
And we have wines that say, no added sulfites, contain sulfites, like on the back label. And that's arguably maybe the least scary of all the different additives that people can add to.
Yes, very true. Wine labels themselves are something that you should be a little bit wary of. Producers around the world, not that this is, you know, 100%, so don't quote me, please, but they have a tendency to use the same label every year, no matter what the alcohol content is, no matter what it is, because it's less expensive to print once.
To print 5 years worth of labels, yeah.
And many times I will get notes from people, you know, in who knows where, in Atlanta, or some, you know, somewhere around the world, and they'll say, you said this wine was, you know, 13.2% alcohol, but I got the wine delivered to me and it says 14.1. And I try to explain, well, that label's from 4 years ago. But, you know, it's very hard to explain that. So wine labels themselves, again, unregulated. They are quote unquote regulated, but really to protect the consumer as far as what's really inside the bottle, we have a long way to go.
Yeah, and I think that the work you're doing is really fantastic to get us there. You're really seeking out the truth. All right, on that note, we're going to take just a quick break. We'll be back with more with John Rimmerman from Garage East.
And the song here is called Don't Marry Mermaids by a band named Mamarazzi. We'll be right back.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat-cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food and Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, and we're back on In the Drink with my special guest today, John Rimmerman, the founder of Garage East, just an outstanding wine newsletter where you can also purchase some of just the most beautiful and real wines that are made in the world. Before the break, we were talking about some environmental factors that go into wine, different chemicals, different additives that people might put in wines and how John stays away from those wines. But I know, John, I know you're West Coast based, and kind of a big issue that's going on right now is a huge drought that's going through, especially through California. And, you know, I just want to know, there's certainly a movement for producers to try to not irrigate. I just got a letter from one of our wine reps encouraging us to not buy irrigated California wines. Is that something that factors into your decision making when choosing wines to feature?
Absolutely. First of all, when I'm choosing something, I don't want to be punitive in advance. I think that's a mistake. I really like to go and observe things for myself. Of course, taste everything, talk to the people that are making the wines. I even like to talk to local people in the area, because you don't often get all the story, you know, just from the winemaker or from the owner of a property. If they have an interest financially in something, they have a tendency to leave some things out. So I will go to local bar, you know, people, or just guys at the cafe. I still do this. This is how I started, and it's served me very well over the years. Ask a few questions about this particular entity or place, or why, you know, why the terroir in their mind is great. And in their mind, the terroir might not be great for wine. It may be great because of climate, and this is something you're getting at. They may go hiking or dirt biking or something through this area, but there's a reason they go on these trails, and it's because the water bypasses it, or it's always flooded. And so in my trade, the difference of a few degrees in elevation can be all the difference between valley floor, very hot climate, and needing irrigation, or what you're saying, you know, getting a kind of an abusive situation as far as using natural resources, versus something that is on a very, very slight incline that may not need that because the vines or the roots have dug down in a very different way. Okay. But as far as being punitive and saying, I'm not going to carry wines because they do, you know, they have irrigation, mm-hmm. a little bit dangerous, also because the vintage is different and the summer is different and every single year. Now we're having a really rough time out in the West. It's just as rough in Washington State. I can give you a little precursor on 2015 if you guys want it.
Yeah, absolutely.
2015 is, if you think 03 in Bordeaux, you are getting good. Yeah. I'll also give you a little precursor on 2015 in Europe. If you think 03 in Bordeaux, you can give another oh no.
And for those of you who aren't aware, just so warm and ripe vintage. Yeah. Wines that don't have longevity and go.
So far the temperatures have been unbelievably hot. It's been over 100 degrees in Paris. Again, just like it was in 03. Wow. You know, we have a long way to go in the vintage, but so far it is looking like an 03 type year, which is very scary. But not just for the vine, for people actually living and perishing in the heat. Now we're kind of going through the same thing all the way through Washington State. Now, Eastern Washington and Western Washington, meaning Seattle, where I'm from, two very different states. On the west side of the Cascades, it's wet. Obviously, where Seattle is, very green. On the west, on the east side of the Cascades, where Walla Walla, the gorge, the areas that are known Red Mountain, it's extremely arid and desert-like always. But 110, 115 degrees for extended periods, that is intolerable to the plants. They shut down even when they're used to that type of a climate. Mm-hmm. So as far as irrigation is concerned, boy, you know, this is a really tough call for me. I would say I tend to look for states that try not to irrigate absolutely right off the bat. Generally, they're older vineyards as well. The younger vineyards can't handle it as much. So we don't have the same old growth in Washington State as they do in California, especially with Zinfandel and some other kind of what I call heritage varietals. This is something that I think, again, it's kind of an all for one, one for all. If you know the producer is someone who has integrity and they're trying to do something that is real of the land, of the moment, of their terroir, and they get stuck with a vintage like this, you sort of have to help them a little bit by supporting them as well. So it's kind of a catch-22. But I do like the ideology of not immediately supporting just we're going to irrigate and that's what we do.
I buy that. I'm with you on that one. And you know, Inba, you mentioned to me at the before the show started, we were chatting. You said that you were on your way over to the UK, and I had actually just assumed you were going to London to go to some fancy tasting. But how foolish of me, because you corrected me during the break that of course you're going to find some cool new vineyard site.
Yes. The UK, this is a question I do get asked a lot. You know, what's the next really cool region? Where should I go visit? You know, what restaurants, all these things. Don't think of just going to London if you go to England. The UK, I have said this over the past couple of years, I really believe is going to be the next great emerging region of Europe. And while there's a lot more, of course, Western infrastructure, and there's a lot more income there to give them a head start over somewhere, let's say like Croatia, which also has amazing old vines, as does Macedonia and Georgia, and we could go on and on, Turkey. But the UK, because of climate change, whether you believe it is so or not, the Champagne region has become warmer, and vintages, as I was just noting, 03, 09, these types of years are becoming more the norm rather than in the 1970s, where very cold, cold vintages were, even the 80s, where it was very difficult even to get the Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, or Meunier ripe. Now it's overripe, overripe, and they're having to figure out, oh my gosh, how am I going to get balance? Well, that balance has moved over the English Channel. And because the UK is 5 to 7, even 8 degrees cooler, and the soil is very, very similar. The cliffs of Dover, the white cliffs that you see, is the same limestone soil that exists all through Champagne. And so in Sussex, south of London, through to the English Channel, they've been planting lots of Pinot and Chard and other varietals, and making amazing sparkling wines that you're going to keep hearing more and more about. And also, for me, the most exciting area is in Cornwall. On the western side of England, again, Doc Martin territory, or you know, if you're fans of TV, that shows that region specifically. It's very small, but you're going to be seeing a lot of sparkling wines coming out of there.
Wow! And at what price point? I mean, I imagine that the land there costs significantly less than the land in Champagne, but. We were also talking about this before. The pound is so, you know, right now the dollar is pretty strong versus the euro, and I imagine that's also helping you give people some good values from Europe. But the pound is still pretty aggressive.
The pound is king, even though people want to think the dollar is king. Really, the pound is still the most aggressive, I would say, currency. And yes, while land is cheaper, because what ends up happening, especially in these unknown regions, is that they're buying up farmland, right? And land that someone wants to discard, but oh my gosh, you go through there as, let's say, a wine enthusiast, and you say, this would be an amazing place to plant a vineyard. Well, they're thinking the same thing. So they're buying some of the farmland, but it is more expensive to begin with, unlike, as I noted, somewhere like Croatia or something like this, where young vintners can still go and try and, you know, do this from the beginning, right from scratch, with very, very old vines that were either left, you know, basically untended for 30 years, left to die off, and start them and resuscitate them from scratch. So, again, catch 22. But as far as what you're going to see faster, I believe the UK, again, because of the Western infrastructure, yes. Yeah.
Well, fascinating. And thank you for continuing to open our minds up and continue to show us just new wines and great new places that we should be looking towards. John, I really appreciate you being on the show. And for those of you who are not on the list, you should definitely check it out. There are fantastic wines at really every price point. I mean, if you can spend the price of a, you know, BMW on wine, on a case of wine, John has that for you. If you want to spend $10 or $15 a bottle, there's outstanding wine at that price as well.
I think really that's what we're known for.
Absolutely.
What I've been known for really since my career started is I don't play favorites with the wines and prices, and we're really known for those $10 to $20 wines that go way above and beyond what you would think that they are. They take a lot of effort to get all the way here to the United States, but it's so worth it. And because our philosophy has always operated somewhat as a co-op, you know, we try and do first come, first serve, and it's very egalitarian. And while people get annoyed by that, then, okay, we will allocate sometimes if something is so popular. But really, The co-op philosophy and mentality that we've had since day one allows me to pass on, as you noted, the savings right now because the euro has depreciated so much against the dollar. Instead of taking the extra margin and having it be, you know, a smart maybe business decision, I would rather pass it on to you guys.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and fantastic. I should say I'm not the one to buy at the higher end. I've been a buyer at your lower end of wine, and always just an outstanding experience with it. So thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So thanks to all of you for listening. I really appreciate it. I also would love to thank our producer, Jory Morales, and engineer, Jack Inslee, and the featured musician from our break today, which was Mama Razi. Subscribe to iTunes. It really helps us if you subscribe. And please do leave a comment. We love hearing from you. And if you want to engage with us on Twitter, we will get back to you. And I also just really did want to send a great thanks to you. We've been doing this for over 2 years, and I look forward to hosting In the Drink every week. It's a highlight of my week. I really appreciate it. And also thanks to our sponsor, Michter's. You can definitely find Michter's rye and bourbon at all of our restaurants. And then coming up next, we have a short clip of Aaron Fairbanks talking seafood with Rick Moonen. Thanks, guys. Bye.
The new technology is study what nature does and emulate it. You know, so they're and so next to these fish farms, they're growing kelp, and they're farming kelp, and they're farming mussels next to that. Super healthy because there's a lot of nutrients come out of the byproducts of the farming, you know.
Chef Rick Moonen knows his seafood. The proprietor of Rick Moonen's RM Seafood and R Bar Cafe in the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas chatted with Heritage Radio Network Executive Director Aaron Fairbanks for a special interview.
I, too, was a member of the voice that said farm-raised salmon was bad. And you know what? First of all, let's understand aquaculture or farm raising, same thing. It's fairly new, you know, and very necessary. More than half of what we consume globally right now comes from farms, and I don't think that's going to change. You know, we've done a really good job of overfishing the most popular species.
Right.
There's a lot out there that aren't popular. That if we could diversify our diet, it would take the pressure off of those wild species to come back. But in the world of aquaculture, a lot of changes have been made over the last 5 to 10 years. You know, they've learned, you know, because when you put a lot of fish, a large concentration of fish in a small area, there's a lot of stress. You know, imagine packing the heck out of an elevator.
Yeah, like any population.
And the guy in the back sneezes and everybody's sick, you know. So that same type of thing is going to happen when there's a stressed out situation. And so antibiotics have to be used in the feed in order to keep them healthy and protect your investment. Escapes happen. You know, they get out and all of a sudden you've got all these fish that didn't really belong in that area in the first place competing for food that the fish that belong there in the first place need to survive. It creates an imbalance in the ecosystem. And for me, that's really what it's all about. Maintaining a healthy environment creates good food, you know, healthy water, healthy fish.
For this entire interview and more of the best food radio on the planet, visit heritageradionetwork.org. This piece was brought to you by the International Culinary Center, culinarycenter.com.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.